lucky this morning to have an introduction to both cosmology and to axions. So I won't spend very much time on motivation, but I will just give you briefly the range of parameters I'm going to be considering. So I'm going to be talking about ultralight axions. So in particular, I mean masses in this range. And the range of masses that I consider here is just completely data-driven. And that's because you can think of 1 over the mass as giving you a length scale. If you want cosmology to give you constraints, purely from gravitational interactions, you want that length scale to be cosmological. So if I was lighter than 10 to the minus 33 EV, that's 100 kilometers per second per megaparsec. That's the Hubble length. If I was lighter than this, I would be dark energy. But I want to talk about dark matter. And if I was heavier than about this scale, then we were hearing about the somewhere around 10 to the minus 20, 10 to the minus 18, we were hearing about the super radiance constraints. Once you're heavier than that, supermassive black holes come in and start, and given that we may see spinning supermassive black holes, you can't be much heavier than this. So this is my interesting mass regime. As Sujeet was telling us, when you have a generalized axion, an axion-like particle, there are 2 parameters, the mass and the decay constant, are no longer tied together. So I'm going to be considering the decay constant separately. I'm always going to be considering large values of the decay constant in the range of the good scale up to the Planck scale. And that's because when I have a mass in this range, in order to contribute significantly to the energy density of the universe, I need to be able to have large field displacements. So I need to have large values of F. So for these ultralight axions, I'm only interested in large values of F. If F was smaller, I would not be contributing to the energy density of the universe. So I would have no constraints. I'll briefly at the end talk a little bit about the QCD axion. And for that case, as we've heard, F is the only parameter you need. And I'll be considering it in the range that's allowed by stellar cooling, and then in the upper limit by, again, black hole spins. But here it's from stellar mass black holes, and here the constraints from supermassive black holes.
Excuse me, please, just to understand, your first line excludes completely what the whole Sujeet's talk, right? His whole range was completely outside.
Yeah, he didn't consider anything this late.
So 10 to the minus 18 doesn't mean that you exclude anything.
No, it doesn't mean, first of all, because
no.
First of all, it comes from supermassive black hole, so you, of course, you should take the grain of salt, but even if you go to higher masses, not all of it is excluded, because he's focusing on that range, because this can give observable signature at cosmological scale.
Yeah.
But yesterday you were saying that 3 times 10 to the minus 11 EV is the lower limit.
That's for the QCD axion.
That's for the QCD axion.
For an axion-like particle, the mass is free.
That's only for the QCD action, and also even that you have to constrain yourself not to go to super Planck inverse, because then there's still available parameters basically for super Planck inverse. So it's a factor of 100, 30 to 100 around there that's constrained. So it doesn't, it's phenomenal. Part of it, this range is also phenomenological, because this kind of signature at ultra light scale.
Yeah, it's a completely, like I said there, I'm being a Bayesian. Looking at these energy scales, you know, we're cosmologists, we're all Bayesians, you should all be Bayesians, and I'm just taking a Jefferies prayer. It's just an unknown scale, and if it does something interesting, I can look for it, and therefore I take a Jefferies prayer on that, and I'm uncertain about it. Okay, so briefly again, as we heard earlier today already, how is axion dark matter produced? So there are 3 stages that happen. First of all, there's the axion is a pseudo-Goldstone boson. There's a spontaneous symmetry breaking at that high scale F. And the axion is the Goldstone mode. So here is the Mexican hat. Here is the scale F. When the temperature drops below F, you fall off. The axion is the Goldstone mode. And you have some random value around this hat. Later on, the mass term turns on. And you can think of that as instanton effect, non-perturbative effect that tilt this hat and give you a preferred minimum. For QCD, this is an effect that turns on at lambda QCD. But for an axion-like particle, this could turn on at any scale. So the mass turns on, but the equation of motion for the axion is this Klein-Gordon equation. It's a damped harmonic oscillator. So there's a friction term. And the friction term is due to the expansion of the universe. It's a Hubble rate. But the Hubble rate is decreasing. So eventually, the friction drops below the mass. And then you begin oscillating. So you begin at some value. You're frozen by the Hubble friction. the friction drops below the mass, and then you oscillate in the minimum. I'm always going to be treating the axions here as a classical field, and that's because when you work out the energy density in these oscillations, it's very large, and you have a large, and you can say it's a large occupation number, so I can treat it as a classical field. And these oscillations scale like matter. By way of comparison, I just want to compare this to something that you might be more familiar with, thermal particles, things like warm dot matter or neutrinos. Why are those axion masses so light compared to what you think of neutrino constraints from cosmology is for EV particles, warm dot matter is for KEV? Why is this so different? So when the temperature is the relevant scale and you're relativistic at early times, when the temperature is large, you're relativistic, the equation of state is a third, you redshift like radiation. When the temperature drops below the mass, the equation of state goes to zero. When, at early times, when you have this large equation of state, the particles are free streaming, there's a large velocity, and they don't cluster. Now, for a non-thermal particle, the relevant scale, as we saw before, is the Hubble scale. When the Hubble scale is larger than the mass, you're frozen, you behave like a cosmological constant. The equation of state is -1. And again, now you're frozen, and you also don't cluster. So in both of these situations, at early times, you don't cluster. So you imprint that scale. You only begin clustering in when these scales are passed. So you imprint that scale on structure formation. And I'll go into some more detail about that shortly. But essentially, if we think during the radiation era, the temperature goes as the geometric mean of the Hubble scale and the Planck scale, because the Friedmann equation tells us that the energy density goes as t to the fourth, the energy density goes as Hubble squared. So just asking that these two transitions imprint the same scale on the structure formation, I can set t equal to the warm dot matter mass, h equal to the axion mass, and you find this relation. So cosmology is going to be constraining very many orders of magnitude different in axion mass compared to thermal particles. And that's where this scale, if you make this KV, this is 10 to the minus 22 EV. If you make this a few tenths of an EV, this is 10 to the minus 32 EV. So this spans that whole range of scales that I was talking about. And this is a cartoon just to compare those two pictures again. So here is matter scaling as 1 over a cubed. This is the log of the energy density, the log of the scale factor. This green curve is something like a massive neutrino. At early times, it scales like 1 over a to the fourth, following the radiation, which is in blue. Then when the temperature overcomes the mass, it starts to scale as 1 over a cubed. And now I've put in an axion, and I've chosen the axion to have the mass, to have that transition occur at the same time as for the massive neutrino. So here, at early times, the axion behaves like a cosmological constant. Then the mass overcomes the Hubble friction at this time, and you begin oscillating, and scale is 1 over a cubed. So that's all of the production of the background relative density of axions. What about the initial conditions? So again, we heard already about from Mark about these adiabatic perturbations due to the inphoton. The axion seeds another mode of perturbations called isocurvature. In the adiabatic mode, all species have this. It's fluctuations inherited from the inphoton. Isocurvature occurs for additional massless fields orthogonal to the trajectory of the inphoton. And the cartoon to understand this is if you imagine inflation's happening up here in this potential, inflation is a motion along this direction. So if at a different point in space, the inphoton fluctuates in a certain direction, reheating, which is occurring down here, will be delayed at that point in space. So that, and because reheating is delayed, it occurs at a lower temperature, there will be a smaller curvature perturbation. So if at one point in space the inphoton fluctuates up here and another it fluctuates here, those two will have reheating, occur at different times, and have different curvature perturbations laid down by the inphoton. But an orthogonal direction like the axion is like this. And fluctuations along that direction don't delay when reheating occurs. So they don't lay down any curvature perturbation. And that's what we mean, that isocurvature. They lay down a fluctuation, and yes, it's a fluctuation in the axion direction, but only later on, once the axion field starts oscillating, does that affect things. And that lays down a dark matter fluctuation that doesn't source curvature in the early universe. And these two different modes are laid down in any cosmology where you have more than one massless field during inflation. But these isocurvature perturbations turn out to be out of phase with the dominant adiabatic perturbations, in a sense, which I'll show shortly. They're out of phase in the CMB spectrum. And because we observe the CMB spectrum the way we do, we can say that these isocurvature perturbations have to be subdominant because we see the phase of the baryonic acoustic oscillations in the CMB. And I'll give you the numbers for that shortly. There are two regimes, one in which you get these isocurvature perturbations and one in which you don't. You only get the isocurvature perturbations if the symmetry giving you the axion is broken during inflation. So if F is larger than H inflation. So for all the ultralight axions I'll talk about, because I demanded that F is at the gut scale or above, I have these additional fluctuations. For the QCD axion, it depends on what your choice of F is. Okay, so now how do I actually start constraining these things? Can I be more precise about the effect on large-scale structure in the CMB? The main thing, as I said before, is this suppression of structure formation by a certain scale. And you can see where that emerges from in this fluid approximation that I'll use to treat the axion field. So once the oscillations begin, just like I was able to say, the equation of state in the background, the energy density was went to zero when you scaled like matter, I can also compute what the sound speed is in the perturbations, in the fluctuations of that effective fluid. So I have a sound speed term, and there are two terms in the equation of motion for the overdensities. These are dark matter overdensities. There's this driving term, which gives you linear growth, and this just comes from substituting the Poisson equation in. This is the gravitational potential, it's the energy density here. And then there's the sound speed, which leads to oscillations. So when k becomes sufficiently large, k is wave number, so large k is small scales. When k is large, the sound speed dominates and density fluctuations don't no longer grow, they oscillate. And this scale is known as the Jean scale. And I can compute where this is. So I said I can tell you what the sound speed is. They can just compute this in this approximation. And it depends on k and it depends on the mass of the axion field. So for larger masses, this sound speed is smaller and the Jean scale, the k is larger. The fluctuations are suppressed on smaller and smaller scales. And so this is the relevant scale. So you see that when my mass is in this range, 10 to the minus 22 EV, I'm affecting fluctuations on scales. Here's 10 squared inverse megaparsecs. So this mass is affecting things on something like a kiloparsec scale, something like galactic scales. As I go lighter, I'll affect things on larger and larger scales, clusters, the CMB, etc. And everything that I'll be showing you, all of these constraints, everything that I compute, we've implemented this with myself and collaborators in a modification of a standard CMB Boltzmann code called CAMB, and we call it Axion CAMB. And we can deal with axions across that whole range of mass ranges with adiabatic and isocurvature perturbations, making up any fraction of the dark matter you want. Yes?
Why would the sound speed not be the speed of light?
So the sound speed is the speed of light in the axion co-moving frame, but that is not the same as the cosmological frame. So the sound speed is one in the frame where there's no perturbations to the axion field. And going from one to this is essentially the gauge transformation from that frame to the synchronous gauge, which is what which is the frame in which you compute all these things to measure. And if you looked at something, I mean, things are obviously invariant on sub-horizon scales, but in the axion co-moving frame, rather than having, you would have the sound speed one, but you would have additional terms here due to the gauge transformation to that frame, which would pick up the same thing, because it's sub-horizon, so it's all gauge invariant anyway.
So can you predict the size of the clusters?
Yes. Yeah, so I'm going to be getting constraints from masses of clusters and things like this. Okay. An aside is just that this Jean scale is equivalent inside halos to the de Broglie wavelength once you take into account the virial theorem. So it's kind of an unavoidable consequence of quantum mechanics and the virial theorem once you're inside halos, in the sense that if I ask what is the de Broglie scale at the virial velocity inside a given halo, it's of order of magnitude the same as this Jean scale. And this actually is another motivation to look at particles at this particular mass, because it might give you cause in dwarf halos, but I'm not going to say any more about that. Okay, so what are the observables that I'm going to be using? One observable is the matter power spectrum. So this is the Fourier transform of the correlation function of galaxies, two-point correlation function of galaxies, Fourier transformed, as a function of wave number. So at larger wave numbers, I'm talking about smaller scales, smaller wave numbers approaches the horizon. The data points here are Sloan, the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. SDSS. The data I'll actually use to show you constraints later is a different galaxy survey called Wiggles, but I just made these plots with the Sloan data. They're essentially the same. So you see that Sloan constrains a range of scales. And here is the clustering power for Lambda CDM. As I introduce an axion with progressively smaller mass, that gene scale appears at progressively smaller k. So you see that I'm sensitive with this measurement to a certain range of masses. The gene scale, in order for me to be sensitive, has to occur in the range in which I have data. Okay? I'm not going to use Lyman alpha because I don't trust it. Because the simulations aren't calibrated for axions, you have to calibrate them. I will get an order of magnitude estimate from Lyman alpha. It's about equivalent to what I'll get from a Euclid lensing survey. But I don't trust Lyman alpha. David Spiegel tells me not to touch it with a barge pole.
Well, but do you have a scientific reason to trust them aside?
Okay, so it's not calibrated. So when you use it for warm dark matter, you have to calibrate the measurements against n-body simulations to be sure that you're really, to get things like the bias calibrated correctly. And there are no n-body simulations for axions. So I don't know how to do this nonlinear stuff. So I can't trust using a constraint like that.
Right.
But I'm working on making those n-body simulations so that I will use Lyman alpha.
Yeah, I mean, even with the factor of 10, the factor of 100, I mean, so for instance, your orange curve falls probably at one inverse megaparsec.
Yeah. I will order of magnitude estimate it. Also, Lyman alpha isn't reliably part of Cosmo MC, so you can't use the same type of Monte Carlo constraints that I use from the other parameters. Okay, here's another effect. So here I'm just changing the mass, fixing the axions to be all of the dark matter. Here I've got a fixed mass like this, but I can reduce the fraction in dark matter that my axion is. So here it's all the dark matter. You can see it does not match the observations. But as I decrease the amount of dark matter it is to about 1%, you become indistinguishable within the error bars. So I'm always going to be thinking of constraints in the plane of the mass versus the fraction of the dark matter that the axion makes up, because I can always turn the fraction down and remove the effect. So I'm asking, how sensitive are you? I'll also be talking about CMB. So another thing is that with the matter power spectrum, there's lots of uncertainty due to things like bias. There's lots of calibration that has to go on, even for this linear theory that hasn't necessarily been calibrated exactly as well for these models as it has been for Lambda CDM. So I'm going to try always, whenever possible, to rely on probes from the CMB because they don't depend on the mapping between where is the visible matter and where is the dark matter, because the CMB is just a gravitational probe, essentially. So I also affect the CMB. Affect the CMB because you can think of introducing this axion that's frozen at early times, basically taking away matter at that time. So by taking away matter, I affect how damping occurs, how the silk damping occurs during the radiation era. And I affect when the radiation matter equality happens. And this distorts the peaks of the CMB. So this is just for those same selection of models before, changing the mass at fixed fraction, changing the fraction at fixed mass, showing you that the CMB temperature peaks are distorted. And the data here is from Planck. Okay, so here are the constraints. These are preliminary. And they're especially preliminary because we're waiting for this bit to converge. So like not all of the chain has been sent to me to make this plot. So our chains are still converging in this region. But I think that this is the level of constraints that we're going to expect. So I'm showing you here constraints from the CMB alone. It probes only slightly larger scales than the matter power spectrum. So the constraint on the mass from the CMB is only at 10 to the minus 26 EV. These are 2 and 3 sigma contours. But whereas if I include the matter power spectrum, it probes slightly smaller scales, so I get a constraint on the mass a few orders of magnitude better. As fraction, I get constraints that this is the log of the ratio of energy density and axions to dark matter. I get constraints at about at the sub percent level. And we think that, you know, the roughly sub percent is going to be consistent when all of these chains have converged. The reason the constraints blow up again at this end is because once the masses become very small, you're measuring very large scales where your cosmic variance is limited. So you've got larger error bars. But you also, as the mass becomes very small, become indistinguishable from a cosmological constant. And so you can replace the cosmological constant with an axion if you so wish. And omega lambda over omega d is of order 1. So the constraints always have this U shape The size here reflects the size of the error bars on your survey. The window here reflects the range of scales that your survey measures. So to get to larger masses, you need things to push to smaller and smaller scales. And that's what I'm going to talk about now. So I think I've got about 5 minutes left.
Yeah.
Okay. So the small scales and high redshifts pushing to higher mass. So now I want to talk about the formation of halos. So here I'm plotting the halo mass function for an axion, 10 to minus 22 EV. The color code is redshifts going from 14 to 0. I'm going to talk about high redshift galaxy measurements. So you see in Lambda CDM, I've got this kind of scale invariant spectrum. I produce lots and lots of low mass objects. This is the missing satellites problem. With axions, I suppress the formation of objects below a certain mass scale. That's this gene scale. And the suppression is stronger at high redshifts. So if I can see objects, if I could see an object of mass 10 to the 8 solar masses at redshift 8, I would be able to rule out a model like this, for example. So that's what I'm going to do. And that's what I'm working on with some people at Hopkins, Brandon Bozek, Joe Silk, and Rosie Wise. And what we've done is we've taken an abundance matching technique. You can use that mass function to turn it into a prediction for the UV luminosity function of galaxies at high redshift, which is a measured thing. So here I'm just showing one plot. I'm not giving you the statistics on this. But this data point here is a measurement of the high redshift luminosity function at redshift 8 from Hubble Ultra Deep Field. And what I want you to show is in this box, this yellow line, this is the prediction for the UV luminosity function for an axion of mass 10 to the minus 23 EV, making up 50% of the dark matter, only 50%. And what you see is there's just no objects of large magnitude. So this magnitude is a log scale, so the minus 12 is higher magnitude. I'm not producing any of those galaxies. So this curve just doesn't get that far. I've seen it, therefore I can rule out this model. So this high redshift observation is really powerful. And we think when we combine the statistics, you see this blue curve is only just consistent. So we think we're going to combine statistics from different bins and also use constraints from reionization using this luminosity function. The constraints will probably get to 10 to the minus 22 EV. It's not as statistically robust as something like a CMB constraint, where you've used Monte Carlo sampling, where we use nested sampling. It's all very sophisticated Bayesian statistics. Here, I'd just be saying, what's the chi-squared of this for varying one parameter? Whereas in the CMB, I vary all of them and do a big Monte Carlo and a proper Bayesian analysis. So this isn't quite as robust to various degeneracies, but it's pretty obvious that this is just inconsistent with the observation of high redshift galaxies. Okay, what are the future prospects? Future prospects are lensing. Lensing is awesome. So very briefly, there's lensing data in existence. We're trying to use this in our chains, lensing data from the CMB. We haven't used it yet, but here is just a sketch of what will happen. This is CMB lensing deflection power measured by Planck at the small data points and by ACT, the Atacama Cosmology Telescope at the large data points. These are the same scales of axions that I was looking at before. And if you look back to the CMB plot, you would see that colors of curves that were consistent with the CMB and P of K are now inconsistent with in particular, this high L lensing measurement by ACT, small scale lensing. So we think that we're going to gain about another two orders of magnitude in axion mass constraint from CMB lensing. So that would hit as far as you can go with linear theory alone. That 10 to the minus 24 EV is about as far as you can go with linear theory. Because then beyond that, the gene scale goes into the nonlinear regime. Here's a forecast for galaxy lensing with Euclid. So here I'm only showing the forecast across the range 10 to the minus 33 to 10 to the minus 29 EV. At the time that we did this forecast, that was the only masses I could deal with. Now I'm working on extending this forecast across the whole range of masses. Euclid is going to get percent to sub-percent to tenth of a percent constraints on axions across that entire range of masses. 10 to the minus 33 because it measures very large scales. 10 to the minus 21 because we're going to be doing nonlinear lensing studies. So that's again something that I'm working on the nonlinear theory for. Okay, and in the last few minutes, I will tell you very briefly about what BICET means for axions. And everything with the caveat of unknown foregrounds. So I'm going to just take BICET at their face value. But as Mark discussed, there are uncertainties about the foregrounds. here's the band of uncertainty on the dust foreground from the Flaugier paper. Okay, I'm going to use just three numbers to do this. I'm going to always be talking about the constraints in single field slow roll inflation in that simplest story for the evolution of the axion that Sergi told us about. I'm going to use three numbers. First of all, scalar amplitude, 2 × 10⁻⁹. Second, tensor amplitude, tensor scalar ratio measured to be 0.2. This gives us the Hubble scale. The third number are those isocurvature perturbations. So I said that they're out of phase with the CMB adiabatic. So the peaks, those oscillation peaks, are shifted by a whole phase in the isocurvature mode. And this constrains the isocurvature amplitude here, which is a function of the axion energy density, to be less than 4%. So this is going to give me constraints across that plane of mass versus fraction, by just combining what is consistent with this and this and this all at once. And you get this. So this is the same plane I showed you before, omega A over omega D on a log scale, the mass ranging from 10⁻³ to 10⁻¹⁸ eV. And the blue line is what you have to lie below in order to satisfy those three numbers. And the other lines here are older constraints in that plane from the CMB and large-scale structure. And what you see, I want you to notice two things. The CMB and large-scale structure constraints that I showed you were independent of any assumption about whether BICEP is correct or not. They stand. They rest only on the adiabatic mode. And they are stronger than the constraints assuming BICEP of quite a large range of orders of magnitude of axion mass. If you take these, they're stronger out to about 10⁻²⁴ eV. And then the tensor constraint becomes very powerful and becomes increasingly powerful as you go to larger masses. So if BICEP holds up, all this range of ultralight axions have to be subdominant in the dark matter. But I think that's a really good motivation to continue to look for them, because it's a way to check, was this correct? Was the simplest story of inflation that I told to get this really the right thing? So that's why I'm continuing to look for the interesting masses at high redshift, regardless of whether BICEP's correct. And that's why I think direct detection, we should still be looking for axions across a huge range of masses, because if you detect them and they're part of the dark matter, you have to modify your theory of inflation to be consistent with BICEP. So I think that's really powerful. We've already seen this QCD axion plot, so I'll skip that. And I will leave you with my summary. This is the range of masses that I've considered. Lighter than 10⁻³ eV, it's dark energy. For the QCD axion lighter than 10⁻⁶, it's low values of the decay constant. And really, I was talking about this range of constraints. So the CMB temperature and polarization probes about 9 orders of magnitude in mass. With that high redshift and reionization in measurements, I can push that by potentially 2 to 4 orders of magnitude further and start to make contact with the constraints that you have from supermassive black holes. In the future, Euclid and LSST are going to cover this entire mass range from the dark energy scale to the scale constrained by black hole superradiance. And if BICEP's correct, it's wiped the floor with a massive, massive range of masses. So that's all I wanted to say. Thanks very much.
Are there any questions? Please, can we have maybe some room lights, please? Thanks.
So could you go back to your plot of natural constraints? CMB and galaxy surveys?
Yeah.
Yes. So when you go to the lower masses, this thing only starts to oscillate
after matter radiation equality.
And at much later time.
Much later redshifts.
So what does it mean, the log lambda A to lambda 2, the omega A to omega D?
So here, when you've got when you're not oscillating, the equation of state's -1. So you're just frozen. And you're contributing as a cosmological constant.
So you're adding as a free parameter in the change, another species that gives a dark matter,
yeah,
not of this range, and you're letting it flow.
I'm letting it flow.
Okay.
And we're doing a nested sampling on that.
Okay. And the second thing is you're treating, so in all of this thing, you're taking a constant temperature independent mass and you're just solving the Klein-Gödel equation.
Yes.
The transition rate.
So the temperature dependence, so even for the QCD axion, if for some reason you could make it this light, then the temperature dependence no longer matters because you have reached the zero temperature value before you start oscillating. So if the QCD axiom was that light, you would only start oscillating when the temperature is below 200 MeV. So the temperature dependence wouldn't matter there. And we ignore temperature dependence here because the non-perturbative physics is completely model dependent, so you just don't know what would give it, so you don't know how to put temperature dependence in.
So I understand the discussion is beyond your model, but I mean, does dark matter lump? I mean, can we talk about lumps of axions, for example?
So in this model, as I was saying, there's this de Broglie scale that there's this gene scale that leads to. I mean, it's the same thing as the clumps that you would get around black holes for the super radiance. There should be some characteristic size of object.
Okay. Look,
say 10 to the 8 solar mass.
Yeah, a specific question is, for example, could we get, I don't know, Earth-sized lumps of dark matter?
In this model, the smallest lump you could get would be, so in this kind of mass range, would be 10 to the 8 solar masses or so.
That question is completely non-linear.
Yeah. So this is for individual particles, right? I mean, you are basically looking at the Compton wavelengths.
Yeah.
I mean, in our language, yeah. So, but say, if you have now interacting in...
If you have interactions...
Right, axions, and you have some... well, I guess you have to have some friction built in, right? Some emission of particles. So it's the next level of model. But is there at least some idea, you know?
Yeah. I think if you had interactions, you would be able to form more smaller coherent lumps, but I don't really know.
They won't be coherent, right? They won't be coherent.
Okay.
So is it possible to construct a model where the inflator, gives you inflation initially and then continues to oscillate to give you dark black valve, so it's one in the same field?
I don't think you'd be able to drive reheating then, because the inflaton has to decay to send you, because when it's oscillating, it would behave like matter, but it has to produce radiation to have the usual BBN and radiation
and
stuff.
Maybe it could, annihilate it with what radiated itself.
Yeah, if you set up the decay rates correctly, you could still have reheating and still have the same scalar be the dark matter, but I don't know of a model that does that.
Okay, maybe we should move on to our second talk in this part of the session, and this would be Joseph Padler from Johns Hopkins.